You're listening to The Point. One of the many things that make the Cape Coast and Island so special is our wildlife. We have a variety of mammals, birds, and amphibians, and unfortunately, human-induced activities can injure and sicken wildlife. We're happy to welcome Zach Mertz, CEO of New England Wildlife Center in Weymouth and the Birdsey Cape Wildlife Center in Barnstable. Hi, Zach.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And Jennifer Taylor's Animal Care Coordinator, Wildlife Rehabilitator at WildCare in Eastham. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello, how are you?
Good. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So yesterday we had a question when Mark Verity was here about birds, and it was about something called fat finch disease, which he wasn't familiar with. Something either of you have ever heard of before? What is that?
I have not heard of that.
Now, how about you, Zach?
No, you know, that may be a term of art I'm not familiar with, but
no.
I suspect people's finch feeding habits may be at the root of that one.
All right. Well, we'll have to do a little more investigating. So about how many animals do you take in each year? Jennifer, we'll start with you.
Okay. We take in about 1,800.
Wow.
It always varies. And yeah, that's a lot. It goes up every year, it seems.
And what about you, Zach?
So between our two hospitals, the one Birdsey Cape Wildlife Center in Barnstable, and then our hospital in Weymouth, we do about 5,000 wild animals a year and another few thousand domestic and owned animals. And I second what Jennifer said, especially on the Cape, we're seeing just a huge increase in demand. So we're going up probably 10% year after year for as long as I've been down here, which is about 9 years now.
Do we know why it's increasing like that? Is it development?
Well, I think,
yeah, go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, I think a lot of it is just the public knowing that we're there. Mm. I mean, it's a peninsula, and we're in Eastham, which is in the Lower Cape, and Zach's place is, you know, midway around Hyannis there in Barnstable. So, you know, we are out there doing outreach, both facilities, and like all year long. So people know we're here, and it's easy to get to either of us. Mm-hmm. And there's tourism. So, you know, all these people come and they look up what to do because they found a gull in a parking lot. And, you know, either Zach's place or our place is right there in front of them.
Yeah. Oh, Zach, what are the most common causes of illness or injury that you see?
You know, they're the big three. And to sort of echo what Jennifer said, because it ties in, no animal shows up without a person attached, right? And so in order to get an animal into care, it takes someone taking time out of their day to stop and look for them. But as a part of that, the ones that we see are the ones that unfortunately run afoul of human interaction. And so, you know, the big three for us are always going to be hit by car, you know, cat or dog interaction, habitat destruction. As people, and we're living our lives, sharing the habitat with animals, a lot of our activities sort of cross their boundaries, segment their habitats, and don't always necessarily coincide with what is healthy for them. And so we end up seeing a lot of human caused interaction. About 99% of our patients actually come to us because of either direct or indirect cause.
You know, was last week, I think, walking to my grandson to school, and I saw a dead rat in the road, right? Hit by a car, which you don't see a lot of rats hit by cars, right? Because they're fast and they're smart. But made me think, I wonder if that rat was slowed down because of, you know, rat poison, rodenticide, and it was gone the next day. So I'm like, did the crows eat it? You know, what happened to it? And if it had, you know, been slowed down by rodenticide, that could be passed on to other animals. And I know you guys see that a lot, right? Are you seeing that more, or is it the same? Talk a little bit about that for people who don't understand what that is.
A few years ago,
a few years ago with the foxes, all had mange, and there was no foxes for a couple of years on the Cape, it seemed. And the rat population exploded. Like we very seldom got rat calls at WildCare, but we were getting people bringing in rats that you know they found in their yard, baby rats that had been abandoned. So that is you know, the circle of life and the balance of the predators and all of that. And almost all the raptors we get in, we just kind of assume they have a level of rodenticide in them. And that rat being gone the next day, of course it was taken by something. A person probably wouldn't have picked up a rat and taken it off the road.
Right. Yeah. Zach, what are you seeing?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's one of those pernicious issues we're dealing with day in and day out, really. I think we are generally seeing an increase in the number of diagnosed cases, meaning that the more we're looking, the more we're testing, the more we're seeing. I know we just sent out four samples last week. All four of them came back, not only for one chemical compound of rodenticide, but each of the samples had at least three different poisons in the animal's liver.
Wow.
And so we know it's a ubiquitous problem. We see it at varying levels, meaning these guys can get, they eat a sicker mouse or rat, they get some level of poison. And we can either, they can be really acute, they can get a really big dose and get sick or die right away. Or in some cases, what we're seeing is it can be sort of a lifelong accumulation where they're getting lower doses throughout their life, but they really can't excrete it out of their system. And so we always compare it to sort of the DDT issue, where it was this huge, sort of widespread issue that we didn't realize how much of an impact it was having until it was too late, right? And we barely just by the seat of our pants hung on. And that's sort of where we feel we're at right now, is we're seeing a huge loss of biodiversity. And the animals that do survive it, we know their quality of life is degraded. We're not sure of the long-term impacts, but we know it's there. And so we're really working hard, both in our hospitals, at WildCare, and then through some legislative efforts right now to try to ban the most harmful of those rodenticide substances, which are the anticoagulants.
It's a horrible way to go. I mean, horrible way to die, right?
Wow,
Yeah.
it's terrible.
Your blood stops clotting. And that is the difference between getting a bumper bruise that is no big deal, you go on with your life, to all of a sudden that bumper bruise is catastrophic and can be life-ending.
Yeah,
And so
when we get these birds in, we get them in because something's happened to them. Obviously, they're either sick or they've, crashed into the road that they've captured their rabbit on. But you can see sometimes just so much bruising in this animal. You open their mouth and they're bleeding out in the back of their throat. So those are the signs that we see.
Yeah, awful. All right. So what are some of the species that you've cared for over the years? And are there some species that you see regularly? I'm thinking squirrels, raccoons, right? Rabbits.
Yeah, and they're all so wonderful. They really are. They don't seem special, but when you get like a downy woodpecker, and it's just a woodpecker, but it's so specific. It's a species, and everything about it is specific to it. And the enrichment that we have to give a woodpecker in rehab is different than the what you'd give to a robin. And it can be just it's a fascinating field to me.
Zach, what about you? Get to that you get the what we would think, right? And then some.
Absolutely. Our sort of rule of thumb is if it's what you see frequently, it's what we see frequently, right? So you can imagine we get a ton of calls about the proliferation of rabbits over the last couple of years. That was far and away our most common patient. This time of year, we're up to our eyeballs in baby raccoons, fishers, and then a lot of the songbirds are just starting to come into play as they're hatching. And it sort of goes seasonally too. So you get peak season for, seabirds, maybe fall, winter, and then you get baby animals this time of year, which is our really busy season. But all told, we see about probably on average 200 different wild species in a given year. And so we're pretty lucky down here on the Cape to have such a wide range of biodiversity.
All right, you mentioned fishers. What kind of a noise do fishers make? I know there's a lot of controversy over that, whether, what the sound
One of my
is.
favorite questions. And so they can do everything from a light squeaking and peeping all the way up to a pretty blood-curdling yell. But I will say they are not the ones that are often responsible for that deep cry that people always attribute to them. Most of the time, that is a red fox, maybe a vixen who's calling. And so fishers in general, you have to think about their survival strategy. They are hunters, they're arboreal, so they're up in trees. It doesn't serve them very well to be making a loud screeching and scaring away all their food. So they're pretty sneaky. And it's part of the reason you never really see them in your yard. They are there, but they're being pretty quiet for the most part.
Yep, the same with weasels. Weasels are everywhere, but you hardly ever see them.
That's right. Tell us more about rules and training for wildlife rehabilitation. People, should not be doing this at home, right? Who can possess and care for wildlife, and what are the protocols for care and release? Zach, why don't you start?
This is absolutely an awesome question. We actually give a training course twice a year. We train about 50 new rehabilitators every year. Some of them go on to get licensed, some don't. Rehab is a pretty phenomenal thing. There's a low barrier to entry, meaning that if you can take the test and you can pass the state test, you get some training, you actually can do this out of your house to an extent. You can't do veterinary care, meaning you can't do, surgery on your kitchen table or prescribe medications or things like that. But there is a good amount of the care you can do, and it's so important because always in Massachusetts, the capacity for care pales in comparison to the need, right? So those folks that can take those baby squirrels at home and raise them up, and they can do some of the minor medical care, and then bring them to places like WildCare or the New England Wildlife Centers for more sort of sharp point vet care, that is a huge part of the equation. And so you have the at-home folks, they have to work with a vet. And then you also have places like WildCare, like us, Tufts Wildlife, there's a few others in the state, and they sort of act as hubs. We see most of the species. Most of us have veterinarians on staff or they come by frequently. And so when animals get into, real serious trouble and need that extra level, they can bring them to a wildlife hospital for a little bit extra help.
Yeah. Jennifer, you want to add anything to that?
Well, yeah, there is a super organization called RAM, Wildlife Rehabilitators Association of Massachusetts, and that has become a really great resource for people just in general with questions about wildlife, but for supporting and mentoring the new rehabbers. And that it's just become a great resource. The internet in general, I've been doing this for a long time, like before internet stuff. And I don't know about Zach, he's young, but the ability to quickly go on to the Slack program that RAM has and just put out that you've got a single baby flying squirrel and they need to have buddies and they're a colony type animal. And you can get a response from somebody maybe in another county or right next door that they've got one too and we need to put them together. So the resources that RAM has and just the internet in general has provided is just a big step up for animal care for all the rehabbers in Massachusetts. And you can just find somebody who specializes in skunks and you just picked up some skunks, you know nothing about them, and they can tell you what to do for emergency care right there. And and what to expect and figure out how to get that skunk to them, that kind of thing. So it's the network is fantastic these days.
What about, we're talking about you shouldn't do this at home, obviously, unless you're trained and you have a license, because the idea is you want to rehab these animals to be able to release them. They're not going to become pets if you're taking them home, right? The idea is to get them back healthy and then back out in nature.
Right. Our missions are to put the animal we that is brought to us back into the wild. So there are animals that so many animals don't make it for reasons. We're kind of like a battlefield hospital. It's an emergency, and most of the animals that we get they're wild. So the fact that a person has been able to come up to an animal and pick it up means that animal is at its last legs. It can't get away from a giant predator who can reach down and pick it up. So, when we get a salamander that a plumber has stepped on, there's no chance that salamander is going to make it. So we do have to call, make, judgment calls because of our resources of time and expense and all that on the immediate intake of an animal. Right, Zach?
Absolutely. And I would mention too, it's a great way to put it, Jennifer. We're sort of doing the emergency triage. A lot of times we'll take it all the way through. But there is a huge level of skill and background knowledge that goes into this. And, we always think about human doctors or, say, your small animal vet where you bring your dog or a cat. They are specialists, right? They have I wouldn't say luxury, it's a hard job, but they know a ton about one or two species. In the wildlife world, when one of, 220 species could walk in your door at any moment, you're never going to know everything about everything. And so relying on a network of people that do specialize is great, but it also means it's not something you can just take in and do at your house because you saw something cute on the internet. There's a ton of natural history that goes into the care of each species. There's a lot of public health risks that associated, especially with things like rabies vector species like raccoons, foxes, especially with the emergence of bird flu. And so if you find an animal and you want to help, the best thing you can do often is observe from a distance. If you think it's in trouble, give one of our facilities a call, give your local animal control a call, and together as a team, we'll find you a good solution for that animal. But oftentimes, taking it in and trying to raise it yourself does more damage than it does good.
Yeah, we often get squirrels because squirrels come to people when they're orphans. They often just climb up your leg and they are adorable. and people tend to keep them, and they keep them until they get sick. And that's kind of, we always, you know, they'll call and they'll say they have a squirrel, and we'll find out that they've had it for 2 weeks. And they get older and they get nasty, and people don't usually feed them the way they should. There's a lot that goes into keeping any of these animals healthy. So we get imprinted animals from people who've had them, squirrels especially, and they can't live with people, and they can't live with other squirrels. And that's a really sad thing when we get them in that state.
Yeah. So if you would, I think what I'm hearing from you is when you see an animal that's obviously not really, really sick, but you're going, is that an orphan bird and not or not? You want to look at it, watch it, right? And give you a call. I mean, do you get people calling and go, okay,
Yes.
here's what I'm seeing, and then you say, just leave it alone. Mom's probably close by, or you say, bring it in.
We love when people call and they're looking at the animal and they can describe what they're seeing, and almost everyone has a cell phone and they can take a picture or a little video and send it to us right away. And that's just fantastic, because we get so many orphan songbirds in that just have been, we call it kidnapped. People are just trying to help, but they see this sad little thing that they can walk up to and it's opening its mouth to be fed, and they just assume it's by itself. And we've all seen this in our lives. That's what I grew up, you know, as a kid, and I'd bring baby birds home to my mother. But we can usually walk it through, and if there's big fresh poops right next to the baby, and there's a robin having a fit above you in a tree, you
Yeah,
know,
that's mom.
that's
Yeah.
being taken care of, and you
Yeah.
should just walk away and leave it alone.
Exactly. All right. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from the vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi, I've got some strange stories. One time, one of my cats caught something, and it looked like it was a mouse. And I made the cat stop and picked it up. And to my horror, it was a baby rabbit with no hair on. It was just born.
Oh.
He must have gotten into the nest. So I took it in the house. It was cold, and as you know, baby rabbits or anything need warmth. And, you know, I couldn't call anybody at that hour. And so I took it in my bedroom and turned the electric heat up to 80, and I'll tell you, that was horrible. And I got an eyedropper and kitty milk replacer, because you're not supposed to feed cow's milk to any of these things. And I nursed that thing until it was, you know, not quite an adolescent, and then I released it.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Bunnies are very hard to do, and especially a day-old bunny. So I think that's almost a miracle.
Yeah.
Well, I
Jim.
used to take him after he ate and let him be near me and be warm with me, and I would pat him. And then as he got older, I let him run around the bedroom. And let me tell you, it was hard to catch him after that. I
Yeah.
had to drop a cloth over him. And then finally, we just put him out.
Yeah.
And the other story I have, I was cleaning my horse's stall, and as you know, you use white shavings in there. So I was going through and getting the manure out of the stall, and all of a sudden, I saw this black thing move. To my horror, it was a baby mouse. So I took it in the house and put it in an aquarium and continued the stall. I was going to release it, but it looked so young. I found another one.
Oh,
And
no.
I brought it in the house, and you never saw such a reunion in your life. I couldn't believe my eyes. It must have been from the same litter, and they were licking each other, and it was just the most amazing thing, the
Janet,
connection.
thank you for sharing your stories, but you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to call the wildlife rehabbers. But Janet, thank you. Got an email from Al in South Yarmouth who says, I admire the dedication your guests show toward injured animals, but short of endangered species, should humans intervene in the balance of only the fittest survive? I watch a number of videos showing countless species of new mothers abandoning some of their offspring to help the stronger survive. What are your thoughts on that, Zach?
You
I'm
know,
sure you get that question a lot.
we do. We do. It's honestly, it's at the crux of what we do. It's an important question. And I'll tell you, our answer is a resounding yes. And I'll tell you why. The reason being, 99% of the animals we get come to us not because of some natural process, but because of some sort of human intervention interaction, right? Nature is efficient. And so it's extremely rare that we will get an animal that's been attacked by another wild animal, because usually those predators will finish the job. Nature cleans itself up. If mom discards a baby, occasionally we'll get something in like that. But by and large, most of the injuries, illnesses, conditions we're treating are because, you know, humans knocked down some trees to build a house because people were driving on a roadway and they hit that animal, or because, you know, we've shaped the land in fragmented corridors and it's, you know, leading to disease spread. So a lot of what we do is focused on trying to sort of repair some of the damage that we've done as humans. And the other reason is to teach. Right? Because it doesn't matter what animal you're working on. If you can bring people into the process and share on amazing programs like this, get people involved, let them know the types of problems animals are facing, and empower them to do something about it, let them know what they can do at home. That's where the real win is. Because, you know, say we treat 10,000 animals here on the Cape between our two organizations, that's amazing, but there's millions that need help this year. And
Right.
so we can share that stuff. That's where the real
Okay.
impact is.
The education is like so, it's so important. We teach so much to people, and I found it's the children who just sponge up the information. So, you know, we get, you know, just a simple thing like people have window wells around their house. These are deep, horrible pits of death for so many animals. And all you have to do is check your window wells. You put a stick in a window well so that, you know, the baby squirrel can climb out of it. And I just, everybody who brings an animal to wild care is, it's an emergency situation for them. They're all freaked out. They've found this animal, they've caused the problem, and they feel terrible. So, like, just to make them feel, you know, just to educate them so they never do it again. You never want to make anyone feel bad for trying to help. You know, we can get a bunch of baby possums brought to us in a bucket with water, and people don't know that they shouldn't have done that. They just, you know, they didn't want to touch them. They dumped them in this thing. They brought them to us, but we can tell them that, you know, maybe next time they find an animal, you know, they should make sure it doesn't go into water, and just, you know, just talk people through it. And they do help other people, and they call back with stories about how, you know, you made this rescue box with my kid in kindergarten last year, and we just used it today. And it, you know, it's like, it's just, it's a really super big thing for the community. And Cape Cod is really, really lucky to have both of our organizations and all the sprinkling of individual rehabbers that are here
For sure. We only have about a minute left, but I'm just wondering, do you have enough volunteers? Are there volunteer opportunities at your organizations?
Totally.
Yes, you're going, yes, both of you. Yeah. So they should reach out.
Sure. We are always looking for volunteers in a couple different flavors. Everything from animal care can come routinely and help out, and then, you know, we're nonprofits and we survive on the generosity of the community. And so we're animal people. We're definitely not carpenters. We're definitely not plumbers. We're not landscapers. So
So
if you
all
have any
kinds of
marketable skills you
volunteers. And
want
we're
to,
not electricians.
yeah.
All right. Zach Mertz is CEO of New England Wildlife Center in Weymouth and the Birdsey Cape Wildlife Center in Barnstable. Jennifer Taylor is Animal Care Coordinator, Wildlife Rehabilitator at Wildcare in Eastham. We're going to post a link with to both organizations at our website, capeandislands.org. So all those people who have those skills can check you out and let you know what volunteer opportunities you can take part of. Thanks so much for being here and for the work that you do.
Thank you very,
Thank
very
you.
much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.